In this week's podcast, I have an opportunity to turn the tables. Normally, I'm the one being interviewed by the press, but in this case, I had an opportunity to interview Robert Scoble. Robert covers a wide range of topics, including his early days with Steve Wozniak in junior college, his time at Microsoft, and he summarizes it at the end with some thoughts on the trends that we should be keeping our eyes on. Enjoy.
This is the Killer Innovations Podcast with Phil McKinney. Keep in mind that the information and opinions expressed in this podcast are Phil's and Phil's alone, and they don't necessarily reflect those of his past, current, or future employers. Now, here's Phil McKinney.
Robert, you grew up here in the Valley, so you kind of had the front row seat in the emergence of the internet. What was it like?
Well,
growing up here, seeing the emergence of companies like Apple and
my dad was a PhD in electrical engineering, and so he was an engineer at Lockheed for 30 years. And same kind of story that Steve Wozniak had, only he was a few years earlier and a lot smarter. I couldn't design my own computer the way that Steve could. I mean, his ability to see, he built the entire Apple II, and had it in his head. And he was probably the first and last guy to do his own personal computer from start to scratch, right? At least a commercial.
Well, it's actually quite interesting because, Steve actually built the first Apple I while he was working at HP.
Yeah.
And he actually took it over to his manager at HP and said, hey, I've done this thing. Would you be interested in it? And famous last words of the large organization. Who would want a personal computer? And so HP actually took a pass on it, and Steve says, well, do you mind if I take it outside and do my own thing with it? And HP's like, sure, go ahead. That's how Apple came about.
That's how the other half of Cupertino got paved over. HP paved over the first half of it, and then Apple paved over the second half.
It actually is quite funny, the fact that we're only one exit away between HP, where we're sitting at right this moment, and we're...
Well, they're moving into your neighborhood. They're opening up a huge new campus over there.
Yeah, actually, they're just on the other side of the... They're just on the other side of the street here. And actually, it's quite interesting when you look at what's happening here in the Valley here recently about... And I don't know if you've sensed it here, but over the last, 3 to 6 months, just the rebirth of startups. I mean, you're just seeing this massive number of new startups that are coming into the Valley. You kind of saw the downturn when the economy was in, but the passion of entrepreneurs is not going away.
Zynga didn't exist 2 years ago, and now they have almost 1,000 employees, right?
Mm-hmm.
And Twitter's there. They have 180 employees. They didn't exist 3 years ago. Facebook is more than 1,000 employees now, and they didn't exist 5 years ago. There's a lot of new companies, and those are the big ones that I can name. There's a lot of little ones, like Yammer, that have, I think, 80 employees and so on and so forth, and there's dozens, or if not hundreds, of those.
Well, and it is interesting how the Valley kind of goes through these cycles.
Yeah.
I remember... I was living in Washington, D.C. before I relocated back to California, and I came out for a visit just after the dot-com bust. It was scary.
Yeah.
I mean, there was no traffic. You could get anywhere you wanted to go because there was no traffic. But, I think, just the whole, the drive for innovation and the drive for entrepreneurs, just, you made me take a pause, but it never stops.
It's really interesting that this started as a farm town because those metaphors still work. The field needs to lay fallow for a while to regather its energy, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that's what happened both times when there was downturns. That we have people who are laid off. My two brother-in-laws were laid off. They're engineers, and one just got a job. So you can tell the economy's slowly coming back to life, and normal people are getting back to work. But we've outsourced our industries here over and over, right? This used to be a farm town. We don't do farming here anymore. So that moved somewhere else, in the world. You buy an apricot, it doesn't come from Silicon Valley anymore. Although it should, because the land here is just grows stuff unbelievably.
As you were saying on the analogy, everything goes through these, cycles, whether it be farms or whether it be, if you think about the technologies in the 60s and 70s to the 80s to 90s, 2000, now 2010, and everything goes through these cycles. And it's amazing how people always predict kind of the end, right? How many times have people predicted the end of Moore's Law? Right? It's amazing. The engineers always figure out a way to extend Moore's Law.
Some of the research you guys are doing with mem resistors are just amazing. At the atomic level, both here in IBM, being able to look at atoms and move those around.
You know, like take little tweezers and all the nano work.
I mean, IBM let me move a single copper atom or a single iron atom across a piece of copper. The fact that you can move a single atom is just, mind-blowing, you know?
And you had to sit down and rest afterwards, right, because it's so heavy.
It was so heavy. I was just clicking on a mouse. It's like, let's build a new atomic structure today, you know? And it's like, that's weird, you know?
Well, when you think back, you started off building your own PCs, right? So when you think back to those days, and I did the same thing. I came up in the PC. I lived here in the Valley and in the early 80s. So having been in that time frame with the advent of the original Apple, the original PCs, and people building, those of us with, the geek side, building our own machines, and then, doing that whole...
I got paid. My mom built Apple IIs at home, and I got paid allowance money to build Apple II motherboards and solder them up.
You know? So, hold it. Your mother was contracted to build them, and then she subcontracted to you.
Yeah, because Apple ran out of factory space in the Valley. And so Hilda Licht, who still runs a company here in the Valley, hired housewives around the Valley to build motherboards, to stuff motherboards and solder them. And Waz, when I met Waz years later, he said those motherboards had fewer failures than the ones they made in the real factories, which makes sense, right? Because they were handcrafted. But I remember, doing that. And then I got a job at HP, a summer job, working the wave solder machine because of my experience using solder, right? And
so you're an ex-HPer.
I was a temp employee. I wasn't full time. But, it worked over in Palo Alto where the HP Labs is.
Yeah, Building 3 downstairs in the factory line.
They used to have a factory line there. And, a bunch of high school kids would be plugging components into motherboards, which is the most boring job. I never wanted that. I was so glad those jobs got outsourced, so I didn't have to do them anymore. It's like, you can have that, China. I don't want to plug four components into the same motherboard every single, five times in a minute, for the rest of my life. It was just,
You saw the dark side.
I saw the dark side of manufacturing, No, I didn't want to do that anymore.
So how did you then go from, growing up here in the Valley to kind of getting into the whole blocking space?
I sort of wandered in my early career, my first life, I got into photography in high school, and I always was interested in technology, but I never could program. Some of my friends went on to work at Microsoft and HP and do some crazy stuff. Because I was in the computer club at High Junior High and at Prospect, and I just never got into programming. I loved playing games. I remember the kid who wrote Choplifter would crack all the games. So my dad would go and buy some new game. And I would take it to school. He would crack it in like 20 minutes, put it and make a copy for our little library. So we had a massive piracy organization in the Valley, which we can talk about now because the Statue of Limitations
has expired.
But,
now.
This is sort of how people learned how to do stuff.
Yep.
It was the programmers were studying how these games were built, and learning from them. And some of those kids went on to make a lot of money. Waz actually developed Breakout, right?
Yeah.
A lot of people don't remember, his Atari days, but he worked for Atari, and he coded the game Breakout in a weekend, right? And got paid $500 for it. Went on to make hundreds of millions of dollars, so he got paid $500 for it. So, Steve Jobs ripped him off. That's another... He got paid $5,000 and told Waz that we only got paid $1,000 or something.
Is that what happened?
Yeah, that's why there's still a little. If you pick up on it, there's still a little animosity between the two of them. That you pick up on here and there. But Yeah.
So anyway, how'd you get from?
So I ran I ran some camera stores in the Valley. I got into photography, almost went into professional photography, but learned that I couldn't make money with that unless you got to be an award-winning photojournalist or whatnot. So I said, oh, I got to earn money, but I still like photography. So I got attracted to working at camera stores because at least that paid, you know, and it fed my hobby so I could get camera equipment cheaper and film. You know, this is the days of film, and film was very expensive. So, you know, that was a beast you had to feed if you wanted to do it. And so, yeah, I got into photography. And in the camera store, I learned how people work, how they buy stuff, how to build relationships, how to build partnerships, how to do advertising, how the sales process worked, all the stuff you learn, how to do inventory,
So you get your MBA at a by actually being in the trenches.
It's really interesting because one of my coworkers now is an executive at Reuters, and we still compare our experience there on the floor at LZ Premiums to an MBA kind of program. And by the way, we kept building relationships. I sold Jean-Louis Gasset his camera, right? And he still remembers that, right? So now he's now a VC in the Valley. So my network started there of people in the Valley who I sold cameras to. I sold cameras to HP engineers and Apple engineers and people now that, you know, look back and say, I remember you sold me a camera and you treated me well. And that kicked off my career in a weird way. Then I finally learned, okay, this ain't going to be a permanent career. You know, first of all, the big box, I could see Fry's and Best Buy were going to totally wipe out the camera store industry. And so I said, I have to go back to school and get out of this industry because I don't want to work at a big box store because I can see how that'll go. You'll be working for, minimum wage forever, you know, and if you're lucky and become a manager, then you'll make 100-something grand, but that's not very much money in the Valley. So went back to school, and I was trying to please my dad, and I went for computer science. I got through 2 years of calculus.
At least you survived 2 years of calculus.
Right? Two years, and the 89 earthquake hit, and I was in physics class, and my first thought was big story. And I grabbed a guy who'd never held a camera, by the way, handed him my camera and wrote a story. He won 2 state awards with his first photographs he'd ever shot because, you know, the earthquake just presented opportunities to snap pictures that were newsworthy. I mean, people, newspapers around the world printed our pictures. Yeah. And, and then got into journalism, switched from computer science to journalism, and right about that time, I met Waz. He was taking a Spanish class at West Valley Community College. Interviewed him, stalked him, interviewed him. So, learned my stalking skills because he parked in the same parking spot at 7 in the morning exactly, every morning. And he's a very predictable person, right? He's an engineer. So he would wake up the same time every day and park in the same spot, and he had a car that said Waz, you know, on it. So he was easy to stalk, and I kept waking up earlier and earlier because I saw his car every morning, and I kept waking up earlier and earlier until I
figured it out.
Well, until I got there at 6:45 and he wasn't there, and then I waited for him. A little story, but we're good friends now. And I talked him out of 40 grand for our journalism department. Eventually, I started studying with him. Nobody knew. He would study right in the cafeteria, and nobody would know who he is. And, you know, this is after he started Apple and was fairly famous in geek circles. But and normal people know the name, but don't necessarily know the face. So, mm-hmm. 'Cause he's not like Jobs. He's not on TV a lot. Now he is, because he was on Dancing with the Stars. But, and we would study and talk him out of 40 grand. And all through my career, I've been in the industries, cameras and printing, publishing, when it's switching from something older to something newer. You know, it's going through a paradigm shift. And right when I was at West Valley in 89, it was going, you know, the personal computing industry was changing how publishing was done. You know, we used to have a mainframe computer to print out the type. It switched to the Macintosh with a laser printer. You know, and then I got to San Jose State, same thing. They had a mainframe computer or a mini computer with big, huge hard drives that were probably like 5 megabytes. You know, big, huge hard drives, like, you know, the size of a file cabinet, 5 megabytes of storage on them. You know, and they bought 100 Macs the semester I showed up. And they were paying some consultant, like $100 an hour. And I said, why are you paying the consultant? I'll set them up for free, you know, because I'm here. That's what I'm here for, is to learn and push myself. So I took the whole summer off, and I had it off anyway, so I wasn't working. I was there to go to school and set up the network of 100 computers and redesigned the school paper and started doing beta testing for Adobe and Macromedia and some other companies. And like, I was one of the first users of multiple master type fonts for Adobe, which don't really exist anymore, but that was a pretty interesting type innovation. And yeah, and so that led to a job at San Jose State. That led to, you know, a job at a computer magazine nobody's heard of. You know,
what was that? What magazine was it?
It was called Basic Pro Magazine. It was like 6 employees and small little boutique Basic magazine, right? Well, this was a year before Visual Basic came out. Microsoft came out with Visual Basic, which just exploded. I mean, eventually went up to millions of developers, you know, who were using Visual Basic to build apps for corporations and other kinds of apps. And so that magazine went from 6 people to 200 people and eventually started a Java magazine and a web magazine and other magazines. And I got into the conference side, and which helped build out my network, because I had to build relationships with cool programmers and people all over the world. And started doing bus trips to Yosemite with a bunch of geeks and lots of fun. And that conference business got me into blogging. And that's what took my career.
So how'd you go from the conference business to blogging, man?
Well, 2 of my speakers said we should do a session on blogging in like 1999, right? And I went to Google, which was pretty new at that time, and I said, there's only 200 people in the world doing blogging. What, you know, this isn't important. And again, not recognizing my own innovation, which was right in front of me. You know, now I was smart enough to do it, but not smart enough to start a conference with it. Now there's conferences on blogging, right? There's conferences on Twitter. I mean, if you told me in 2000 that there would be entire conferences on blogging, I would be like, what? Because there was only 200 people in the world that were doing them, you know? And it didn't seem like it was going to be the kind of innovation that totally demanded its own conference. So they talked me into doing one, and within 3 weeks I was hanging out with Dave Weiner, and he linked to me, and it sent me 3,000 people with one link, and I was like, wow, there's a lot of people reading these things. There's not a lot of people writing them, but there's a lot of people reading them. And it was just, I didn't realize at the same time what a disruptive innovator Google would be. And Google, as it became more and more important, pulled along the blog. And because the blog was the best way to get data into Google. And so as Google got more important, the blog got more important, right?
Mm-hmm.
And now the company to watch is Facebook. So Facebook, as it's getting more and more important, it's shifting all sorts of things around the web. You know, these like buttons, for instance. Now you see TechCrunch putting these like buttons on TechCrunch, right? What does that mean? And what's that going to mean 5 years from now? You know, that's where it's interesting.
But you're kind of the person that people see as being the person that kind of cracked the code on corporate blogging.
Yeah.
So you went from doing the conference. So how did you make the leap from doing the conference into helping the suit side of the world understand the...
That was in 2000. And I took a lot of risks along the way. And... So I was working for Fawcett, this magazine company, and with my blog, I almost got fired because I leaked some news about Microsoft's .NET system before anybody else did. And that pissed off Microsoft. So I learned what pissed off Microsoft. That's a key. And I'd been in the Microsoft feeding trough for a while. So I knew a lot of people there, and I knew sort of the culture. So studying it.
You almost got fired from the magazine.
Yeah.
But then eventually, through your career, you end up working for Microsoft.
Yeah. So I almost get fired for leaking about .NET, which is sort of funny. I get unhappy about dealing with my boss, you know, because I see that he's not willing to take risks and make something happen. He's trying to collect money from Microsoft, so, you know, I'm tired of this. And at that same time, the .NET bust happened, right? March 2000, the world just evaporated. And it evaporated in a very real way in my face, right? Because in 99, we had 60 sponsors of our web conference. In 2000, we had 2 sponsors of our web conference. So in 1 year, we saw our business just go away. And it's like, So I knew I had to be smart about where the world was going. And I saw this blogging thing happen. So I went off and started working for Dave Weiner. That lasted for 8 months. And I was answering phones, doing the blog, you know, and trying to launch a product with him. And watching the books. And I was watching the cash go away. At the end of 2001, right? 2001, that period was just massive change in my life. So I had a car accident. 9/11 happened. Got a divorce in December. Got engaged with my new wife, who I've been with ever since. My grandma died, shipped Radio Userland for Userland, and in March ran out of cash and laid myself off. So, all in like 5 months. I was like, okay, well, I've survived all this crap in my life. What else is going to happen? But the car accident really set off the divorce and set off changes in my life. Because I realized life can whack you at any time. So why don't you live life large, you know, go for it. Go, you know, live it to the best you can every day. Because you might not be here tomorrow. So, you know, don't live with any regrets, right? Go for it. And that led to working at NEC, selling tablet PCs, which we'll talk about in a second. And that led me to sell some tablets to a Microsoft executive for Bill Gates. And I was always an MVP in this area. So, you know, I was going out to Microsoft regularly and seeing the latest stuff and building relationships. And and Microsoft was going through a PR struggle. This was the post-DOJ era, you know. It's like, how do we put a human face on this company? How do we make ourselves look nicer? Because we can't be the rapacious company that we were in the 90s. And so they were looking for ways to shift. I think that's what happened. I got my job, and I was told not to blog on company time, but keep doing it. You know, keep experimenting and teach our people how to use this.
Hold it. Blog, but not on company time.
Yeah.
So you started when you were at Microsoft, when you first started doing the blogs and all that.
There was only 80 blogs at Microsoft, right? And blogging was not an accepted PR structure. They had no clue what it was going to be and how it, you know. And there was this old school of PR, which is, we're going to talk to the New York Times, and you're not, you know, as an employee. You know, we're going to let Steve Ballmer talk to him, and we're going to do it on very specific terms, and we're going to control everything. So this blogger comes along and, like, writing to the world, here's what's going on inside Microsoft today. You know, here's what we're talking about in the cafeteria. And eventually, you know, a few months later, we started this video show, Channel 9, where I just carry around a little video camera. And that got to, by the time I left, we were getting 4 million visits a month on that little $250 video camera, which shows how the world shifted, right? Microsoft has a multi-million dollar TV studio. I got some of those people laid off because they weren't getting the hits I was with my $250 video camera. You know, so why did we need a multi-million dollar TV studio again? You know, and it, the world has shifted
right.
because of the internet. The blogs and the ability to push media to each other in a low-cost, high-quality way was extraordinary.
While you were at Microsoft, you were also known as kind of being a little bit of the antagonizer inside the organization, right? And some of the listeners of the podcast, these are people who are trying to be change agents.
Yeah.
They're trying, whether it's blogging or trying to get an organization to move out of its old way of doing things.
It goes back to the car wreck. I knew what I was going into, and I was going in there to change it, right? I wrote, the week I got the job, I wrote this corporate web blogger manifesto, which is still a great document. And I wrote it to myself. I said, these are my principles going in here. If you get fired for keeping to these principles, then fine. You know, take some risks and stay to those principles. And they were just common sense things, you know. Tell the truth, you know. Answer concerns before anybody else does. You know, don't leave a concern out in the public unanswered. And then there's a whole range of stories that those principles stayed true to and changed PR, right? But I was always telling people, Google's taking over the world. You better pay attention to them. I remember Bill and I having an email conversation. Google invited me to speak at Google because I was one of these people like, well, this guy works for Microsoft, but he's always praising us. We've got to figure this out. what's going on here? You know, we might as well have him come and speak at our conference, you know.
So the evil force coming on.
Well, you know, there's always partnerships even with the worst of competitors, you know. There's deals going on. So, yeah, I got a tour of Building 43, which is now my current life, right, Building 43 at Google. And in the lobby there, they had a screen, a big HD screen, which showed all the searches being done in the world as points of light coming off the Earth. And so, like, New York is a solid column of light, and San Francisco is a solid column of white dots pouring off of it, you know. And Redmond was a solid column of white light pouring off of it, right? And I went back and I wrote Bill and I wrote to one of the internal mailing lists because we have these great mailing lists inside the company. And I said, you know what, I just was at Google and we're doing more Google searches than the entire continent of Africa at Microsoft. And, you know, the reason our search engine sucks is we're not focusing enough attention on it. And I said, why don't we turn off Google at Microsoft campus? And forced the team to improve the search so that all the employees will like it, you know, and also all the employees will be pissed off for a little while because Google's better, but they'll give feedback to the search engine team, like, fix your search engine, you know, and make it work for us, you know, so that we don't have to go to Google anymore, and put a lot of pressure and heat on that team and attention. And he wrote back within 20 minutes, which is why Microsoft is one of the more interesting companies in the world. You know, to have that kind of level of dialogue, six levels deep, you know, with Bill Gates, and in open public, right, in inside the corporation. And he's like, no, we already argued that out. there's people who want to do that here, but I don't. I think we need to learn from our competition and figure out what they're doing right and have an open policy to the world. But they still haven't figured out search 5 years later. And so, you know, was that the right decision? You know,
given what you've done, though, in kind of that, you know, what you did at Microsoft, et cetera, and you look now at corporations who try to use blogging, what are corporations getting right and what do they get wrong? Because, I mean, you still see a lot of companies out there kind of fumbling around.
Yeah. Partly I visit big companies a lot, and it's like, oh, look at my blog. And it's like, blogging is so 2001, first of all. Why are you showing me something new? Why are you proud of something that's cool in 2001? And now it's just a fact of life. It's like water, you know. I like people who tell me, who talk about story and narrative better. You know, mm-hmm. Like, hey, we have a story to tell, you know. And blogging is a piece of that. You know, the bloggers are a piece of that. But we have a great new product. You know, HP has a new slate coming out. You know, what's the story behind that? What does it do different than the iPad? And how are we going to communicate that to the world? You know, to me that's more interesting. And then blogging is just one of the menu items on how to communicate that story. It's mm-hmm. a tactic. It's not the strategy, right?
Right.
But a lot of companies look at it as blogging as strategy.
Exactly.
It's like, that's nuts, you know. that's not the first conversation to have. Should we do a blog or not? Of course you should do a blog, but you know,
don't stop.
That's not the right question.
Right.
You know, the right question is, what's the story you're trying to tell, and how are you trying to shift the world's attention on something? You know, and today that might be a YouTube video. I mean, one of my YouTube videos got watched 300,000 times this week. It might be a tweet, right? Mm-hmm. It might be a Facebook message. It might be a blog site, old school blog site. You know, there's still value in that.
Mm-hmm.
If you have a story and you have the pieces that make that story interesting,
you kind of have this ability to kind of see the trends.
Yeah,
the shifts that are happening. Kind of read the tea leaves.
Well, I study early adopters. That's really what I do. I have 7,000 friends on Foursquare. The average user has 7. So I have 1,000 times more friends than the average user. And I do that because I can study early adopters in a new way. Same thing on PlanCast. PlanCast is a service where I can study which events early adopters are going to, you know. And I can study that worldwide. So I know where I should fly tomorrow. You know, I'm going to Israel partly because of that calendar, right? And I have 18,000 people I'm studying on Twitter, and they're handpicked. You know, people like you, people, you know, engineers and executives and venture capitalists, they're all on Twitter lists. If you visit my Twitter page, you can see I've segmented them out into lists of people, right? Press, you know, so I have the best PR list on the planet. And I just study them. I watch them all night long. You know, what are they talking about? What are they doing? You know, how are they reacting to this new Facebook stuff? And that gets me invited. Now I get invited to see news events. Like I was in the front row of the Facebook announcements this week, which were monumental. I think we're going to be talking about what Zuckerberg's doing for decades.
So what are some of the new trends? I mean, like, you do have this front row seat, whether it's physical or virtual.
Yeah.
So if you had to look out, what are the trends that we all should be, you know, paying attention to?
I like using the word battlefronts more than mm-hmm. trend. So mobile right now is a battlefront, you know, and HP is a major player there. Windows Mobile 7 is trying to stay relevant with Google Android and with Apple's iPhone, right? And BlackBerry is, I think, in the next couple of years going to struggle because it's not the device that most of the bleeding edge people want in their hands. It has the best keyboard. Now, what happens if Android figures out how to get a great keyboard on their device,
mm-hmm.
along with a great web OS? Because BlackBerry's OS sucks for developing apps. Every developer who builds for BlackBerry complains about it.
Well, BlackBerry's has been rumored for years to be trying to rewrite the core, but it's hard. Well, it's hard to disconnect from what you've got. Everybody wants to say, "Well, I've already got this. Let me."
Innovator's dilemma.
Yeah. Well, it's even more than that because the challenge being is getting particularly software engineers to let go of code and start with a blank sheet of paper. So, well, I've already got this. Let me tweak it. Versus sometimes you got to use the meat cleaver.
Yeah.
And you got to disconnect.
Microsoft did that, right? So they mm-hmm. their Windows Mobile 7 is completely a rewrite.
Right.
But then they saw the writing on the wall that Apple had really whacked the whole industry with its iPhone. And so they know they have to rewrite it. And BlackBerry still has market share because of their keyboard and their Exchange hooks.
So what do you think the innovator's dilemma problem is for Google? I mean, they're getting to be a size now that's not...
Google's problem is infrastructure. So they have, you know, a million computers in data centers around the world that were built to index the web, and the web used to be web pages, right? It still is. We think it used to be web pages, and its algorithms would study the linking behavior between those web pages. Obviously, it's changing now, but the Facebook and Twitter world is not web pages at all. It's messaging. It's these little messages that are streaming through these systems. And these messages then can be routed to buckets like my Twitter lists, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, think about my Twitter lists. Those aren't pages anymore. Those are streams of messages that are coursing through the system. That's quite different than the systems that Google's infrastructure was built to study and built to build a search engine for. So now Facebook comes along, and their entire company is built around these new, a new graph for your social graph, you know, your friends, and streams. So you build a graph of your friends. You know, you say, hey, this person's my friend, this person's my wife, this person. And then it builds a stream that shows up on your page or shows up on your phone or shows up. And that infrastructure is radically different than what Google's is. And Google is struggling to keep up with what Facebook's doing to it right now. Google Buzz shows that they just don't have a clue about the social graph. They don't
I was going to ask you about Buzz, what your thoughts on Buzz was.
They don't have a clue about how people work. And they're way behind, and they're struggling. They're like Microsoft was with Google, right? Google really radically whacked Microsoft, and Microsoft just couldn't deal with what Google was because Google was built for a new world. Microsoft built software to put on CDs, right? I mean, I've been in Building 26 where they compile Windows. It takes 7 hours to compile Windows 7 with a bank of supercomputers, you know? And put it on a CD, and then they have whole infrastructure to mail the CDs out around the world. You know, that's quite different than what Google was built to do, right? Google's what's a CD?
What's a CD?
and we just turn a switch and change a line of code, and now you have a new feature in the search engine. You know, or the search algorithm reordered that web page for searching for whatever, and.
So back to your battlefront analogy. You talked about mobile as being one of the key battlefronts. What are some of the other battlefronts that you're...
Now streams. It used to be social networks. I think the social networking war is firming up. It's Facebook with a little bit of Twitter, and Google is struggling. You know, and Microsoft, what? I haven't heard of anybody. Although Microsoft and Yahoo have all these old school users, right? They have hundreds of millions of Hotmail users at Microsoft and hundreds of millions of Yahoo email users at Yahoo, and AOL's still out there with its AIM. You know, so they have users, but they haven't figured out how to build a social graph out of those users like Facebook has. Facebook has a new database that they just turned on an API for. So now you can study this new graph, this web of users that and how they fit together. Well, now Facebook's going over to Yelp and saying, well, we have this new data, a little like button. Put this like button next to all your restaurants, right? And people can click like on restaurants. And now we can show you all the friends, your personal friends that have liked that restaurant. You know, so you can see, oh, my friend Jane likes this restaurant. I'll go check that one out next time. You know, and that's very powerful and very disruptive to Google because now we're going to do searches for restaurants that have Facebook information, and it's going to bring back better information than Google has, you know, on some searches. And so Google's, if I was working at Google right now, I'd be freaked out. I'd be like, oh, man, how do we deal with Facebook? I think that's a major war that's going to be going for two, three, 4 years. The graph wars are going right now. Twitter has a graph of its own. It's trying to stay relevant. I think Facebook just majorly did major damage to Twitter.
Thanks for listening to this week's podcast. To augment what you've just heard, we've produced a two-disc, two-hour CD called Creating Killer Innovations. The CD covers such topics as the management of innovation, the skills of innovation, and the Killer Innovation Methodology. The CD is available on Amazon or at philmckinney.com. For feedback to today's show, please send an email to podcast@killerinnovations.com. For more information or to connect via Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn, or to connect to the broader community of listeners to the podcast, visit philmckinney.com. Again, thanks for listening to today's podcast. I truly do appreciate the time out of your busy schedule, and we'll talk to you real soon. Bye-bye.
This series of interviews with innovation thought leaders is made possible by support from thenextbench.com. For more information on the series and to listen to the previous episodes, visit thenextbench.com.